For all these reasons, Theaetetus, we must admit that refutation is the greatest and chiefest of purifications, and he who has not been refuted, though he be the great king himself, is in an awful state of impurity. He is uninstructed and deformed in those things, in which he who would be truly blessed ought to be fairest and purest.
Very true.
And who are the ministers of this art? I am afraid to say the sophists.
Why?
Lest we should assign to them too high a prerogative.
Yet the sophist has a certain likeness to our minister of purification.
Yes, the same sort of likeness which a wolf, who is the fiercest of animals, has to a dog, who is the gentlest. But he, who would not be found tripping, ought to be very careful in this matter of comparisons, for they are most slippery things. Nevertheless, let us assume that the sophists are the men. I say this provisionally, for I think that the line which divides them will be marked enough if proper care is taken.
Likely enough.
Let us grant, then, that from the discerning art comes purification, and from purification let there be separated of a part which is concerned with the soul. Of this mental purification instruction is a portion, and of instruction education, and of education that refutation of vain conceit which has been discovered in the present argument, and let this be called by you and me the nobly descended art of sophistry.
Very well, and yet, considering the number of forms in which he has presented himself, I begin to doubt how I can with any truth or confidence describe the real nature of the sophist.
You naturally feel perplexed, and yet I think that he must be still more perplexed in his attempt to escape us, for, as the proverb says, when every way is blocked, there is no escape. Now, then, is the time of all others to set upon him.
True.
First let us wait a moment and recover breath, and while we are resting, we may reckon upon how many forms he has appeared. In the first place, he was discovered to be a paid hunter after wealth and youth.
Yes.
In the second place, he was a merchant in the goods of the soul.
Certainly.
In the third place, he has turned out to be a retailer of the same sort of wares.
Yes, and in the fourth place, he himself manufactured the learned wares which he sold.
Quite right. I will try, and remember the fifth myself. He belonged to the fighting class, and was further distinguished as a hero of debate, who professed the aristic art.
True.
The sixth point was doubtful, and yet we at last agreed that he was a purger of souls, who cleared away notions obstructive to knowledge.
Very true.
Do you not see that when the professor of any art has one name, and many kinds of knowledge, there must be something wrong? The multiplicity of names which is applied to him shows that the common principle, to which all these branches of knowledge are tending, is not understood.
I should imagine this to be the case.
At any rate we will understand him, and no indolence shall prevent us. Let us begin again, then, and re-examine some of our statements concerning the sophist. There was one thing which appeared to me especially characteristic of him.
To what are you referring?
We were saying of him, if I am not mistaken, that he was a disputer.
We were.
And does he not also teach others the art of disputation?
Certainly he does.
And about what does he profess that he teaches men to dispute? To begin at the beginning, does he make them able to dispute about divine things, which are invisible to men in general?
At any rate, he is said to do so.
And what do you say of the visible things in heaven and earth, and the like?
Certainly he disputes, and teaches the dispute about them.
Then, again, in private conversation, when any universal assertion is made about generation and essence, we know that such persons are tremendous argufiers, and are able to impart their own skill to others.
Undoubtedly.
And do they not profess to make men able to dispute about law, and about politics in general?
Why, no one would have anything to say to them, if they did not make these professions.
In all, and every art, what the craftsman ought to say in answer to any question is written down in a popular form, and he who likes may learn.
I suppose that you are referring to the precepts of Protagoras, about wrestling and the other arts.
Yes, my friend, and about a good many other things. In a word, is not the art of disputation a power of disputing about all things?
Certainly, there does not seem to be much which is left out.
But, oh my dear youth, do you suppose this possible? For perhaps your young eyes may see things which to our duller side do not appear.
To what are you alluding? I do not think that I understand your present question.
I ask whether anybody can understand all things.
Happy would mankind be if such a thing were possible.
But how can anyone who is ignorant dispute in a rational manner against him who knows?
He cannot.
Then why has the sophistical art such a mysterious power?
To what do you refer?
How do the sophists make young men believe in their supreme and universal wisdom? For, if they neither disputed, nor were thought to dispute rightly, or being thought to do so were deemed no wiser for their controversial skill, then, to quote your own observation, no one would give them money, or be willing to learn their art.
They certainly would not.
But they are willing.
Yes, they are.
Yes, and the reason, as I should imagine, is that they are supposed to have knowledge of those things about which they dispute.
Certainly.
And they dispute about all things.
True.
And therefore, to their disciples, they appear to be all wise.
Certainly.
But they are not, for that was shown to be impossible.
Impossible, of course.
Then the sophist has been shown to have a sort of conjectural or apparent knowledge only of all things, which is not the truth.
Exactly. No better description of him could be given.
Let us now take an illustration, which will still more clearly explain his nature.
What is it?
I will tell you, and you shall answer me, giving your very closest attention. Suppose that a person were to profess, not that he could speak or dispute, but that he knew how to make and do all things, by a single art.
All things.
I see that you do not understand the first word that I utter, for you do not understand the meaning of all.
No, I do not.
Under all things, I include you, and me, and also animals and trees.
What do you mean?
Suppose a person to say that he will make you, and me, and all creatures.
What would he mean by making? He cannot be a husbandman, for you said that he is a maker of animals.
Yes, and I say that he is also the maker of the sea, and the earth, and the heavens, and the gods, and of all other things, and further, that he can make them in no time, and sell them for a few pence.
That must be a jest.
And when a man says that he knows all things, and can teach them to another at a small cost, and in a short time, is not that jest?
Certainly.
And is there any more artistic or graceful form of jest than imitation?
Certainly not, and imitation is a very comprehensive term, which includes under one class the most diverse sorts of things.
We know, of course, that he who professes by one art to make all things is really a painter, and by the painter's art makes resemblances of real things which have the same name with them, and he can deceive the less intelligent sort of young children, to whom he shows his pictures at a distance, into the belief that he has the absolute power of making whatever he likes.
Certainly.
And may there not be supposed to be an imitative art of reasoning? Is it not possible to enchant the hearts of young men by words poured through their ears, when they are still at a distance from the truth of facts, by exhibiting to them fictitious arguments, and making them think that they are true, and that the speaker is the wisest of men in all things?
Yes, why should there not be another such art?
But as time goes on, and their hearers advance in years, and come into closer contact with realities, and have learned by sad experience to see and feel the truth of things, are not the greater part of them compelled to change many opinions which they formerly entertained, so that the great appears small to them, and the easy difficult, and all their dreamy speculations are overturned by the fact of life?
That is my view, as far as I can judge, although, at my age, I may be one of those who see things at a distance only.
And the wish of all of us, who are your friends, is, and always will be, to bring you as near to the truth as we can without the sad reality. And now I should like you to tell me whether the sophist is not visibly a magician and imitator of true being, or are we still disposed to think that he may have a true knowledge of the various matters about which he disputes?
But how can he, stranger? Is there any doubt, after what has been said, that he is to be located in one of the divisions of children's play?
Then we must place him in the class of magicians and mimics.
Certainly we must.
And now our business is not to let the animal out, for we have got him in a sort of dialectical net, and there is one thing which he decidedly will not escape.
What is that?
The inference that he is a juggler.
Precisely my own opinion of him.
Then, clearly, we ought as soon as possible to divide the image-making art, and go down into the net, and, if the sophist does not run away from us, to seize him according to orders, and deliver him over to reason, who is the lord of the hunt, and proclaim the capture of him, and if he creeps into the recesses of the imitative art, and secretes himself in one of them, to divide again, and follow him up until in some subsection of imitation he is caught. For our method of tackling each and all is one which neither he nor any other creature will ever escape in triumph.
Well said, and let us do as you propose.
Well, then, pursuing the same analytic method as before, I think that I can discern two divisions of the imitative art, but I am not as yet able to see in which of them the desired form is to be found.
Will you tell me first what are the two divisions of which you are speaking?
One is the art of likeness making. Generally, a likeness of anything is made by producing a copy which is executed according to the proportions of the original, similar in length and breadth and depth, each thing receiving also its appropriate color.
Is not this always the aim of imitation?
not always, in works either of sculpture or of painting, which are of any magnitude, there is a certain degree of deception. For if artists were to give the true proportions of their fair works, the upper part, which is farther off, would appear to be out of proportion in comparison with the lower, which is nearer, and so they give up the truth in their images, and make only the proportions which appear to be beautiful, disregarding the real ones.
Quite true.
And that which being of there is also like, may we not fairly call a likeness or image?
Yes.
And may we not, as I did just now, call that part of the imitative art which is concerned with making such images the art of likeness making?
Let that be the name.
And what shall we call those resemblances of the beautiful, which appear such owing to the unfavorable position of the spectator, whereas if a person had the power of getting a correct view of works of such magnitude, they would appear not even like that to which they profess to be like? May we not call these appearances, since they appear only, and are not really like?
Certainly.
There is a great deal of this kind of thing in painting, and in all imitation.
Of course.
And may we not fairly call the sort of art which produces an appearance, and not an image, fantastic art?
Most fairly.
These then are the two kinds of image-making, the art of making likenesses, and fantastic, or the art of making appearances.
True.
I was doubtful before in which of them I should place the sophist, nor am I even now able to see clearly. Verily he is a wonderful and inscrutable creature, and now in the cleverest manner he has got into an impossible place.
Yes, he has.
Do you speak advisedly, or are you carried away at the moment by the habit of assenting into giving a hasty answer?
May I ask to what you are referring?
My dear friend, we are engaged in a very difficult speculation. There can be no doubt of that, for how a thing can appear, and seem, and not be, or how a man can say a thing which is not true, has always been, and still remains a very perplexing question. Can anyone say, or think that falsehood really exists, and avoid being caught in a contradiction? Indeed, Theaetetus, the task is a difficult one.
Why?
He who says that falsehood exists has the audacity to assert the being of not being, for this is implied in the possibility of falsehood. But, my boy, in the days when I was a boy, the great Parmenides protested against this doctrine, and to the end of his life he continued to inculcate the same lesson, always repeating both in verse and out of verse. Keep your mind from this way of inquiry, for never will you show that not being is. Such is his testimony, which is confirmed by the very expression, when sifted little, would you object to begin with the consideration of the words themselves?
Never mind about me, I am only desirous that you should carry on the argument in the best way, and that you should take me with you.
Very good, and now say, do we venture to utter the forbidden word not being?
Certainly we do.
Let us be serious then, and consider the question, neither in strife nor play. Suppose that one of the hearers of Parmenides was asked, to what is the term not being to be applied? Do you know what sort of object he would single out in reply, and what answer he would make to the inquirer?
That is a difficult question, and one ought to be answered at all by a person, like myself.
There is at any rate no difficulty in seeing that the predicate not being is not applicable to any being.
None, certainly.
And if not to being, then not to something.
Of course not.
It is also plain that in speaking of something we speak of being, for to speak of an abstract something naked and isolated from all being is impossible.
Impossible.
You mean by assenting to imply that he who says something must say some one thing?
Yes.
Some in the singular you would say is the sign of one, some in the dual of two, some in the plural of many.
Exactly.
Then he who says not something must say absolutely nothing.
Most assuredly.
And as we cannot admit that a man speaks and says nothing, he who says not being does not speak at all.
The difficulty of the argument can no further go.
Not yet, my friend, is the time for such a word, for there still remains of all perplexities the first and greatest, touching the very foundation of the matter.
What do you mean? Do not be afraid to speak.
To that which is, may be attributed some other thing which is.
Certainly.